Hello and welcome to another SPAC Insider podcast, where we bring an independent eye in interviewing the targets of SPAC transactions and their SPAC partners. SPACs have brought a number of sustainability companies to market, but the economics of carbon credits have always been on the edge of those specific opportunities. Focus Impact Acquisition Corp. aims to change that with its $213 million combination with DevStream. DevStream is a Canadian company focused on generating carbon credits with proprietary technology-based approaches. I'm Nick Clayton, and this week I speak with Sunny Trin, co-founder and CEO of DevStream, and Carl Stanton, CEO of Focus Impact. Sunny explains how DevStream has worked to build confidence in carbon assets by consulting its wide pipeline of clients on getting better and more measurable impacts out of projects. And Carl tells us why he believes DevStream's operational efficiencies and capital-light model make it a unique play on the carbon market and a stable fit for the current market conditions. Take a listen. So right off the bat, Sunny, you know, DevStream made news recently with a big multi-year agreement to sell carbon credits to an oil and gas company that could pull in millions in revenue over the coming years. What can you tell us about that agreement and how it came together?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're doing that's different is we work on technology-based credits that are a lot more precise as far as like the quantification and the impact. We're also working in the compliance market as well, too. So one of the issues right now in the carbon credit market is that the voluntary space, there's a lot of, I guess you say, a little bit of chaos going on, concerns about greenwashing. And so we are working on what a lot of people consider high-quality credits. So this company, they identified that or saw that we were doing these things, and also we're working in the compliance space, so the regulatory markets up in Canada. And they approached us saying, hey, we're really interested in what you're doing, because they couldn't find enough high-quality credits. So they actually approached us and asked, hey, would we be interested in a contract to sell some of these credits? And after multiple discussions, we finally agreed that was good for both sides. And so that's how we engaged and ended up finalizing the contracts.
Right, and you mentioned that these are, you know, Canadian compliance credits, and those look to be a large part of what you expect to have in terms of your workflow moving forward. But how are those different from, you know, some of the other carbon credits out there, maybe in other jurisdictions, or as you said, you know, there's some that are a little more chaotic and amorphous?
Yeah, so the two main areas of in the carbon market is voluntary and compliance. So voluntary, as the name implies, is for regions where there's no government requirements on emission reductions. And companies like a Microsoft or a Google, they make their commitments based on what they want to do, and also demand or pressure from, I should say, from shareholders and from their customers. And so they voluntarily buy these credits that are on the global market, and where NGOs are the registries that issue the credits. In certain jurisdictions, like in Canada, for example, there are programs where if a company doesn't meet certain emission thresholds, they will get taxed or penalized. And in order to offset that, they buy carbon credits or compliance credits that can be used to offset their emissions as well. And in those markets, the price is typically regulated, so the price is much more predictable. And also, because you're offsetting a tax or penalty, the demand is much higher as well, too. And so that's why we feel a lot more comfortable. As the market's evolving, the compliance market is much more predictable and allows us to have a lot better view of our, you know, future financial models.
Just how big is the carbon credit space that we're talking about here? And how many competitors do you really have within it right now?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, Nick. So taking a step back, right? As we all know, global warming is a massive problem, with the main cause coming from greenhouse gas emissions, such as carbon dioxide. So to address it, right, the United Nations and countries throughout the globe have created emissions reduction goals and have signed agreements to meet them. And along with these goals, they created a financial mechanism called carbon credits that reward activities that reduce carbon emissions. So when an organization or country does something that eliminates, avoids, or sequesters carbon from the air, they would receive one carbon credit for every metric ton. Well, if you take a look at the goals that these organization countries have created, they're by no means small. It's estimated that we will need to reduce 23 billion tons of CO2 annually by 2030, and over half of this will be driven by carbon credits. So this is why the carbon credit market is so massive. In 2023, it's expected to be over $1 trillion and growing to $2.68 trillion by 2028. And the way we look at it is, it's one of these industries that's relevant to just about every organization and country in the world, because everybody's affected by global warming. So either there's going to be a company with a net zero goal who has emissions that need to buy carbon credits, or there's a company that's doing something good that generates credits. You fit one or the other. And so when we're talking to organizations, a lot of times, you know, I'm talking to my wife and she's like, well, why are you talking to this company or that company? We talk to sports organizations, we talk to hotel chains. They're all relevant And that's what makes its market so massive. And then with regards to competitors, up to this point, majority of the carbon credit developers are focused on the nature base. It's not right or wrong. It's just kind of how the market has evolved. But again, in order for us to really achieve our goals, there's been studies done that nature-based solutions will only address up to 20% of the solutions necessary. So the other 80% needs to come from technology. And there really isn't many other companies that are doing what we're doing on the technology side, just because, again, it just happens to be our background, our DNA, and we happen to intersect it. And so there's really not anybody doing what we do. And I'll give you one example. We have an MOU, and this is public information, with a $2 billion Japanese distributor called Ryoden. They distribute high-efficiency HVAC systems, refrigeration systems, EV chargers. All these things are eligible for generating carbon credits. They flew out to LA. I met with their team, and we spent half a day talking about how all these things are eligible for carbon credits. They spent about 6 months going back, doing their evaluation and research, and ultimately came back to us and said, yeah, this is something that we want to partner with you because we can't find other resources to be able to do this. So we feel that right now, we probably have like a two-year head start because, again, of our intersection. And other folks are going to come in as these things, as the market evolves, gets bigger, and hopefully we become more successful. We're going to find a lot more competitors. But for now, we feel we have a two-year head start to sign these companies like a Ryoden, to sign municipalities and cities and get our arms around as many of these projects as possible and really grow. And that's one of the reasons why we're partnering with Focus Impact to get us on a bigger exchange and also bring in more resources as well too.
Rated for Carl, you know, as we just mentioned here, that this is an evolving market. What got you and the Focus Impact team first looking at the opportunity here in environmental assets, and how did that path get you all the way over to DevStream?
It's a great question, and I have to go back a little bit in time to when we founded our firm, Focus Impact Partners, and created this idea that we wanted to find companies that were doing something good for the planet, but also creating top-tier financial returns. That's an important element for us. My partners and I have all been private equity investors for the bulk of our careers, in my case, over 30 years. We've had the opportunity to run multiple private equity firms. And when we created this one, it was really done with that mandate. So when we started the search in 2021, you might recall that's when all the growth stocks went away. And finding great companies was really hard. We started to pivot towards companies that were in the middle of a major transition. And when you look at what's happening in the carbon credit space, it's the poster child for that. The UN, starting with the UN and all the signatories to the various accords, have effectively mandated that carbon credits are required to be a part of the solution of the declimatization work that's being done globally. So how do you play that? How do you assist companies in developing them? It's an industry that's littered with, or mostly populated with nonprofits, and it's got some cottage industry aspects to it. There are a lot of people that are developing projects that they're very passionate about, but they don't necessarily know how to get those credits to market. They don't know how to turn those into an actionable project. And that's where DevStream really fits in. DevStream's really, in a way, we got lucky. The introduction with Sunny was timed almost at the same time that there was a negative article about a very certain type of carbon credit, nature-based carbon credits, that came out in an international newspaper. And that same newspaper has gone on to continue to investigate the industry and has really done some good service to the industry to call out bad actors. But they tend to be very, very focused on nature-based credits. And Sunny's group was almost exclusively focused on technology-based credits. Some of the problems with nature-based credits are of inherent challenges that are make them hard to measure and to maintain don't exist in the technology world. So we believe that Sunny and his team were really onto something extremely unique that fit the times. If the world needs carbon credits, and you know, McKinsey was estimating that the demand for carbon credits voluntaries is going to grow 50 from today's levels by the end of the decade. So if you need carbon credits and nature-based credits are under fire, then technology-based credits would be a major part of the answer. So we hit it off very quickly. It fit very much the theme that we were trying to stay true to. And that's how we got to today.
Well, that leads us right into, you know, talking about those technology-based credits. And so, you know, Sunny, how does that whole process work? How do you identify an opportunity, generate that technology-based credit, and then get it to market?
Yeah, so that's kind of our secret sauce. And it's also our DNA. So most of our team are engineers or physicists. I have an engineering background, engineering degree as well. We have four PhDs in our team. And so it's not that we have anything against nature-based, it's just not where we came from. We just happen to intersect it at a technology level. So having that background and that knowledge, we work with a lot of different organizations that come to us and they bring certain types of technology. We take a look at it and see if it fits the carbon credit market, if there are certain methodologies in place that will make them eligible to generate credits. And then our model is that we provide a full turnkey service where we literally do everything from identifying it, validating it, registering it, getting it certified, and generating the credits. And our model is simple. We don't charge these organizations one penny, so there's zero risk. Our fee is that after we generate the credits, we keep typically 25%, give or take, 25% of the credits. And so we're bringing them a stream of revenue they're not seeing. And we're helping really advance their technologies because a lot of times these technologies come at a cost over maybe lower, something that is more commonplace that has higher carbon emissions. And so by bringing the stream of revenue, we all help offset that cost and really advance the technologies. In addition, we work with a lot of other organizations and including municipalities where we can bring these technologies into the municipalities and almost act as their biz dev. And then at the same time, we work with municipalities as well, where we will sit down with a city planner or a mayor, identify all the activities that they're doing. And from there, we would be able to help them generate credits and bring revenue into the city. So that way, as the city is advancing towards a more green or sustainable environment, we can help pay for some of that rather than coming out of taxpayer money. And I'll give you one example, Nick. We have one city we're working with in Canada that's looking at electrifying their municipal buses. Well, the city had no idea that that was eligible for carbon credits. Well, we're coming in and managing that and generating the credits for them to help pay for, and offset some of the costs or even maybe lower the fares. So that way it encourages more usage and things like that. So in the end, this extra stream of revenue actually really helps advance these technologies. And kind of like what Carl said, because with technology, the data is much more precise. There's less opportunity for greenwashing or overestimation and things like that that exists in the nature-based world.
Great. And getting into your proprietary part of this, because I think, people are perhaps, familiar with some of the basic sort of things, we've mentioned here in terms of finding efficiencies or electrification and things like that, but those are technologies that are out there. But your piece where you're able to, apply some of your secret sauce, as you say, in terms of, the measurement and even you mentioned that you use, a bit of blockchain tools. How does that all work and why is that an important piece in this?
Yeah, one of the biggest issues in the carbon market is there's a lack of transparency on how the data used to generate the carbon credits was generated. And so like with nature-based, it's really hard to measure the true impact of, say, let's say you have like 100,000 acres of Amazon rainforest. There's no way you can measure every single tree. So a lot of it's done with models. And with models, it could be relatively easy to overestimate. And that's what's been happening in the market. And at the same time, when folks are buying these carbon credits, they don't see that overestimation or the models, and it's really hard to get that data. So what we do with our blockchain is that we're not using it to tokenize or do any of that. What we're doing is we're creating almost like an open ledger where any stakeholder who's looking at buying the credits or looking at investing into a project can see how the data was calculated, where it came from, and all the transactions around the credits themselves. So this way, everything is an open book, and it allows for that trust and the opportunity to really get under the hood and see all the details. And so we have a proprietary blockchain from our sister company, Devio, that we use that we feel is the greenest blockchain out there as well. And we provide all that transparency, put all the data on that and on top of everything else we're doing on the technology side.
Great. And you have the two different models of how you generate revenues in your presentation between the two sides of carbon investment and carbon management. How do those two different business models and returns differ between those approaches?
The carbon management is, like I said before, when we go and identify other technologies or maybe municipalities and help them generate credits with projects they're working on or doing. So we don't make any investments into those. And because we're not making any investments, and when we get our 25%, it's almost like a SaaS model where there's very little and almost no CapEx. It's just the cost of generating the credits, verifying it, validating it. That's the only cost that we bear. And then outside of that, everything else is essentially profit. And in some cases, we'll identify projects that we may want to put that requires CapEx that might be worthwhile for us to invest in. In those projects, sometimes they're a lot more mature. They're a lot further along. The group might already have done some of the work already. So it gives us credits sooner and it allows us to be a little more active on that side as well too, and get maybe a larger portion of the credits.
Got it. And so, you know, we've touched upon some of the skepticism about ESG out there at the moment, and, you know, how, you know, the difference between, you know, nature and technology based carbon credits. But also, I just sort of found it interesting because, you know, a lot of the lines of criticism are kind of, as you've mentioned, that, you know, greenwashing, and there's an appetite for ESG, then, well, companies are just going to slap green on just about everything. But I found it interesting that in your materials, you noted a couple of projects where you either didn't give it certification or found that it actually would cause more harm than good as a part of your consulting process. And so could you just walk us through a little bit about, you know, like, what are you looking for, and what are sort of the different levels of investigation when you're really assessing some of these things?
Yeah. So we have a proprietary 32-step process where we look at everything from financial risk, engineering risk, environmental risk, and financial risk as well too. And we score each of these different categories. And that's how we decide whether we move forward with a project or not. And the example that you're sharing, Nick, was actually really interesting. We're working on a hydrogen project that was being, hydrogen was being exported into another country with a project developer. And we have found that the energy used to generate the hydrogen was generating more emissions than it would save on the other end when the other side was using the hydrogen. And so in this way, it actually helped the project developers because it allowed them to identify something that they didn't see in the first place and then move that hydrogen generation to a lower emissions region where the electricity doesn't have as much emissions as well. So these are things that we do just kind of even beyond of our typical, you know, generating carbon credits, but we help some of these projects move into a better space so that way they don't run into issues later on. Because imagine if they're generating credits off of this and then somebody does an audit and all of a sudden it's like, well, wait a minute, you know, these credits are actually false because you're generating more emissions than you're saving.
You know, there is a lot of anti-ESG talk here. But what's interesting about it is that most people agree that climate warming is happening and that we have to do something about that. And so what's interesting about Sunny's business, you know, the backdrop is it's a $1 trillion market. Carbon credits today are a gigantic market. It is substantially larger in Europe than it is in the US, but most of that is compliance. But that market is likely to continue to grow, projected to continue to grow, you know, another 2.5-fold over the next 5 years. And of course, as I said before, the voluntary market is going to grow 50 times. So what's really happening there is as governments and similar entities are deciding that they have to do something in order to protect their populace, they're increasing the amount of compliance markets that are out there. The voluntary markets are largely fueled by corporations that have made pledges to their stakeholders that they're going to reduce their carbon impact. So carbon credits are an output of that. Now, we've been a big believer that charity will get you so far. You know, people will feel good 1 year, maybe the next year not feel good. But it really has to be something that's self-sustaining. And that's where capitalism has solved so many problems. And we are capitalists. I don't think you have to really believe that in any ESG movement to believe that if I'm a corporation and as part of my process, I need to bring energy costs down. That's just part of what I'm doing. And I can do that by employing certain technologies. They probably don't recognize yet that they can also oftentimes get carbon credits out of that. So they're getting paid to do something that that's good for them anyways, that's good for the environment anyways, but then also can generate credits that other people can use to offset something maybe they can't, an industrial process they can't further reduce. So this is why we think it fits anybody, no matter what side of the aisle you sit on, you have to say that, well, this is it's just good business. It's good business, it fits capitalism, and it's the creation of a new market that will enable this to continue for generations and not just be subject to the political whims of a period of time.
Yeah, Nick, if I can add to that as well, too, I can cut up some really good points. The way to look at it, too, is some of the issues that people have, right, or some of the criticism is that we're giving companies a get-out-of-jail-free card. Well, a lot of times these companies, they're doing these activities anyways. And so by creating a financial mechanism or a vehicle, they're going to be paying for somebody else to do something good. So if we didn't have carbon credits, that money wouldn't have flowed over to these other projects or help advance these other technologies as well too. So in effect, we are helping advance the good side. Yes, we're giving a little bit of leeway to the bad side, but it's also helping mitigating it by offsetting it with the good projects.
Definitely. And so moving over to the deal somewhat, DevStream is already a publicly listed company, granted not on one of the, the larger exchanges globally. And so can you explain why the opportunity to jump up to the NASDAQ brings so much value here?
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, being on the Canadian exchange in Cboe, I mean, Cboe have been great partners with us. It's just much smaller. We're not seeing as much liquidity. And also carbon was like the hottest thing since sliced bread in Canada a couple years ago. But, it's a relatively fickle market, and due to some other companies not performing as well, the market turned and flipped literally 180 degrees, not quite overnight, but pretty much close to that. And we're in the position where we have over 140 projects in our pipeline. We have an opportunity to really grow and really expand and also create even more of an impact. We're also considered to be one of the world's leaders in the carbon space by organizations like the United Nations, for example. So by jumping on to NASDAQ and partnering with Focus Impact, it gives us a lot more visibility, creates a lot more liquidity for our stock, but also allows us to raise capital as well too, to be able to take on many of these projects. And one of the beauties of technology is that it's very scalable. So we have a billings efficiency program, for example, that would aggregate any activity that billings do all across North America. Well, as we sign on more real estate partners or hotel chains, well, we need more resources as well. I mentioned working with cities. Well, we have a couple of cities right now we're finalizing agreements with. Once we get those under our belts, we got 24 more cities behind that. Again, that requires more resources. So all these things, I think, allows us to move much quicker, and then also allows us to really establish ourselves and put our stamp on the marketplace as the leader, especially on the technology side.
Yeah, and just to add in there, DevStream will be the only carbon credits company with that's listed on the U.S. exchange. The U.S. exchanges are, obviously the most liquid and most regulated in the world. And if you're holding yourself out as somebody who's selling or helping market carbon credits, which have been subject to so much scrutiny, we thought it made a tremendous sense when Sunny came with that idea to want to provide that level or subject yourself to that level of scrutiny and transparency that's required by an SEC registered company, a NASDAQ listed company. Well, that's why they're doing it. The carbon credit market is primarily, it's dominated by nonprofits and small independent companies that have no transparency. So this is a move towards, we think will happen over and over again, where people will realize that if public companies want to deal with other public companies, they want that level of scrutiny on their financial statements. So this is a step towards that end.
Well, and going further into that, given how unique DevStream would be as a standalone play on a big exchange like the NASDAQ, Carl, just how did you go about establishing a valuation for the company? And, what did you see as being some of the most logical public comparables? And what were some of the key metrics, that you find to be informative for investors to sort of understand the value here?
A great question, and not an easy one, as in a lot of emerging industries. Mm-hmm. There were no pure play competitors to what DevStream was doing. So we triangulated on it with companies that were in the energy transition space that were that may have had carbon credit exposure or in green industries. So using those metrics, you could then start to delineate where DevStream stood out. And it stands out kind of in two different ways. One is obvious, its growth. It's growing from a very, very low base to a market that is expected to be very, very large. So that's easy to stand out. Many of these companies, let's say sometimes companies in the space are compared to mining companies or companies where there's a stream of revenue that's coming out. We think that's a poor comparison, but we understand why people would say it. Those companies don't have much growth. They're not known for their growth. The other thing is that DevStream's model is effectively a consultative model, because their proposition to businesses by and large is, we will do the work for you. We will get you your credit, your project put onto a major registry, and make sure that process is seamless, and we'll monetize the credit for you on the other side. That is a consultative model. It's a very high margin model, a high free cash flow model. And in Sunny's company's case, it doesn't require much in the way of capital expenditures. So it looks very different from most companies, because it's, you don't have to have a big plant. You're not building major infrastructure. It is driven off of know-how, IP, and extreme knowledge and connections in this space. So that's why high margin, high growth. Yes, not many competitors when we came up with our valuation, we took a very, what we believe to be an appropriate discount to what the median of all those companies we've laid out on our presentation would say. And that's how we developed it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Some of the, you know, the different business models you mentioned there, different companies in this space and different ways you could look at it. It was something that, that crossed my mind, and perhaps the space is just, you know, too early for it. But I do wonder if, do you expect at some point in the future there will be enough, you know, carbon credit generation out there that there would be, you know, companies that could potentially position themselves to be valued in a similar way as mining companies, and that there is sort of a bank of credits and they're valued based on their NAV that they're holding. Do you see things getting to that point where there's value in holding a certain amount of credits and building value that way? Or do you think the consultative model is the way to stick on it?
Well, we believe that the market will, as it matures, it'll attract more capital, more companies will be public. That's all a good thing because we're trying to accomplish that goal. But as that happens, the rates of return won't be quite so easy, and perhaps the growth rates will be different. And like in any market, we'd expect that maturation to lead to consolidation and all the things that happen on that end of it. Today, however, and for the foreseeable future, there is just growth. It's just people using carbon credits more to offset their emissions. And what DevStream will have the opportunity to do will be to decide. Today, the models are run with the notion that the carbon credits are sold as soon as they're developed. There's no asset management component to what DevStream does, but it is an obvious offshoot of what could happen, that environmental assets in all their forms are becoming more mature. They're going to become, obviously, you know, more popular and eventually more regulated. And you could imagine that, much as in other asset classes, new asset classes, that as they grow, there'll be an asset management component to it. So we could see that happening. We think there's so much growth in the next 5 years that'll be an interesting next step.
Sure. And looking at the deal itself, again, your materials note, you're aiming to raise a $33 million pipe. And we've seen, you know, some signs that the pipe market is starting to open up again a bit more for SPACs after, you know, a pretty difficult and pretty tight year in terms of arranging those, you know, instruments. So how have your discussions been going, and what kind of investors are you prioritizing getting involved in the deal?
Well, it's interesting. Sunny brought a team of people from his group to COP28 in Dubai in the fourth quarter of last year, and we joined with him. You know, Sunny's team were invited to speak on a number of panels. They have high notoriety in that space. And that was the beginning of the conversations with let's say, people that are defined buyers of environmental assets and investors in for all different reasons. So some of them are doing it for economic reasons. Some of them are doing it because they really believe that that's their mission. There are a number of people that are interested internationally in what DevStream is doing. And so we've been courting those since that time. And, you know, of course, we can't say how that will ultimately play out, but those groups are people that you would expect to be long-term holders of the company over the long term. In the near term, the group of there's another subset of investors that have been stalwart investors in these types of assets for decades, and that would include smaller institutions and family offices that you would normally see in cause-based initiatives like this one. DevStream has the benefit of allowing them to have liquidity and to have return attached to it. It's not meant to be a gift to the world. It's meant to actually create return. So those are two groups we're courting very heavily. And of course, the group of investors that tend to participate in many de-SPACs, the loosely speaking, the event-driven hedge funds, those groups, we do see that they've become much more active and they've become much more interested in ways to become bigger players into de-SPACs. So it'll end up being a mix of all those three groups of people that ultimately come to do it. I have to point out again that the company does have a very asset-light model and a low burn rate, which gives Sunny and his team the opportunity to really pick who they want to partner with. It's important that your investor base appreciates that this is going to be an interesting and fast ride, but it's going to have elements of which you mentioned before. ESG was a very easy conversation to have 2 years ago. Not so easy to have that conversation today. So we don't say those words. We say it in a different way.
Yeah, definitely. But as you mentioned the model there, and, you know, I guess talking about operations a bit more as well, you know, DevStream does project to generate positive EBITDA already this year and has, according to the presentation, you know, really fairly low corporate and operational expenses. So, you know, I guess what are just some of the key things that you see Sunny as being, you know, the key things you need to execute on this year to hit those goals and to maintain the momentum moving into 2025?
Yeah, one of the challenges with the current credit market is the amount of time and effort to generate a credit is fairly complex and lengthy. So it's a good news, bad news, right? The good news is that it creates a lot of barriers for competition. And that's why we've kind of been able to create our own nice little niche to be able to do this. Bad news is, like I said, it takes a little bit of time. And so that's going to be the biggest challenge, is going through that process, trying to speed it up. And at the same time, we're also helping evolve and improve the market to shorten that amount of time using things like our platform, using technologies and so forth as well too. So first, that's probably the biggest challenge, is just the amount of time it takes to generate the credits. Like, the good news though, on the flip side, once we do, we get our programs up and running. And that's an advantage we have too, is, and I'll touch on it in a second, but once we have it up and running, bringing on additional clients, bringing on additional project groups allows us to generate credits much quicker. And so our approach is, rather than doing one project at a time, we go and register an entire program that aggregates multiple projects in that same type of technology. And that's one of the advantages technology allows us to do that. So I mentioned before, like, we have a building efficiency program where a building owner or a hotel chain or whatever, upgrading any kind of equipment to improve their energy efficiency. So maybe improve HVAC systems or LED lighting. They're eligible for generating credits. So each time we bring on a new client, rather than starting a project fresh, we just roll them into the program that we've already registered and have them up and running literally within a day or two. So it's much quicker and it's much more efficient for us as well too. But it does take a lot more time to get up and running, a lot more complex. And that's where, like I said, we've created a little nice little niche.
And I noticed that, you know, you expect to be taking in a huge portion of your revenue through those efficiency projects this year, but alternative energy is going to become a bigger part of the revenue pie beginning next year. What are some of the things you're looking at there, and what do you see in that shift?
Yes. Oh, it's again, it's part of the energy transition, right? In order for us to meet our net zero goals, you have two ways of doing it, right? Reduce the emissions and the energy consumption. And the other is to electrify and start switching over to much more renewable energy. And that's where we're kind of playing and hedging both sides of it. So if one nice thing is with our model is that we don't need both or everything to hit in order for us to succeed. We can, and by hedging and looking at different technologies and different approaches, if one or the other succeeds, we're going to be able to hit our number and be able to hit our forecast as well too. So we have some wiggle room there. And that's why I mentioned before, we have 140 projects in our pipeline. We don't need 140 projects to hit. We just need a fraction of them. And some of them are alternative energy, some of them are energy efficiencies. And even in the nature-based side, we are working on some of those to help some of these nature-based programs by bringing in technology as well to address some of those issues that we mentioned earlier.
Sure. And I guess just, you know, looking ahead at the various different things, the various different new technologies, new regulatory frameworks, all the different things that are coming here. And even just looking at, I guess, the, you know, the verification and sort of the distribution side in terms of the marketplace. I mean, you are partnering with Expansive, which I find to be a very interesting place in the things that it's doing in terms of providing that, you know, a marketplace for credits and, you know, perhaps a little bit, you know, more price certainty and things like that. Just, you know, among the various moving pieces that are out there at the moment, what are some of the things you're most excited about seeing in terms of the development of this market?
I think the biggest piece is addressing all those concerns that around greenwashing and reputational risk and so forth, to really button up the carbon market. Because we honestly believe that in order for us to meet these net zero goals, you absolutely have to have a carbon credit market. But there's been a lot of issues, and that's why we've had some pause and the market's, you know, slowed down a little bit, but it's still gonna happen. You know, when you talk to CEOs and when we talk to even countries, you know, whether it's ministers or presidents, a lot of them that have net zero goals, most of them have no idea how they're gonna hit it. So they're going to need to buy carbon credits. They're going to need to be able to, you know, depend on organizations like ours. And we need to have, you know, dozens more dev streams out there. And we'll be happy if that's the case. But this market is going to grow. And as we help evolve it and make it better and address these issues, it's become much more reliable and dependable. And then carbon credits will become a financial asset. That's when, like Carl mentioned, a lot more capital is going to come into it. And even though it's a $1 trillion market now, if we are able to fix a lot of these issues, it would be much, much bigger and much more impactful in helping us address all these issues, but also create a whole new market where financial organizations will want to jump in a big way.
Yeah, and I would add on to it. We're looking forward to the driving force behind this is likely to be corporations. And, you know, as is the case in a lot of times, when nations are trying to figure out how to handle something, a lot of just basic businesses decide that they start to do it themselves. And so the voluntary market is driven by that. Not just big businesses, small businesses, individuals can all participate in this market. And as that happens, and as people start to realize that there is a bit of capitalism in there, and you don't have to feel bad about that. You can feel like that allows us to believe that it's going to be sustainable. Then we believe it could really grow quickly. And that's what we all need. I think we need it to be viewed as viable. It needs to be viewed as honest and fair. And that, we believe, will create the volume necessary to really make a dent. You know, I'll give you an example. There are a number of high-profile projects doing a very specific type of carbon capture. It's called direct air capture. And those projects are attracting venture capital money and high profile money. And we very much applaud those projects. They do require new technology. They're expensive. The estimates are that the cost per ton of carbon removed from the environment is upwards of $1,000 a ton. Now, carbon credits, if you look at the average carbon credit that the Fortune 50 would report, are being bought for $20 to $30 a ton. So DevStream's approach has always been that a ton of carbon is a ton of carbon, whether or not it's just not emitted or whether or not it's sequestered and put into the ground, it's still a ton of carbon. And so finding ways to be rational and helping people be rational about this is just a cost of production or this is just a benefit and you can measure it and there's a market so that it's not subject to interpretation and guess. That, we believe, is going to fuel this whole decarbonization part. That's what's going to really get us out of the hole that we're in.